This is Audible.
Brilliance Audio presents Hawk, Three Black Ops by Ted Bell, performed by John Shea. Crash Dive. South China Sea, present day. Midnight. No moon, no stars. The sea a flat black void a few feet beneath his wingtips. For a man streaking through the night over hostile foreign waters at nearly the speed of sound, at an altitude no sane man would even dare consider, Alex Hawk was remarkably comfortable. He was piloting an F-16 Viper. The matte black American-built jet fighter was one of many purchased and heavily fortified by Britain's Royal Navy for under-the-radar special operations just like this one. Lord Alexander Hawk, a former Royal Navy pilot and combat veteran of the Gulf War, now a seasoned British intelligence officer with MI6, had to smile. Like the Syrian hospital bed he'd only recently escaped, the sleek F-16 single seat reclined at an angle of exactly 30 degrees, transforming the deadly Viper, Hawk thought, into something along the lines of a supersonic Barca lounger. Leave it to the Americans to worry about fighter pilot comfort. His eyes flicked over the dimly lit instrument array and found nothing remotely exciting. Even the hazy reddish glow inside the cockpit somehow reassured him that all was well. He was less than 600 nautical miles from the tiny island of Sichuan, his destination, and closing fast. Every mile he put behind him lessened the chance of a Chinese Sukhoi 33 jet interceptor, or a surface-to-air missile blasting him out of the sky. Although equipped with the very latest anti-missile defense systems, the Viper was no stealth fighter. He was vulnerable, and he knew it. Should he be forced to eject and was captured by the Red Chinese, he'd be tortured mercilessly before he was killed. A British intelligence officer flying an unmarked American fighter jet had no business entering Chinese airspace. But he did have business, very serious business, and his success might well avert impending hostilities that could lead to global war. That was his mission, and he'd gladly chosen to accept it. In London one week earlier, C, as the chief of MI6 was traditionally called, had summoned Hawk to join him for lunch at his men's club, Boodles. Lord Hawk had thought it was a purely social invitation. Usually the old man conducted serious SIS business, only within the sanctum sanctorum of his office at 85 Albert Embankment. So it was a very relaxed Alex Hawk who presented himself promptly at the appointed hour of noon.
There you are at last, Alex, C said, amiably enough.
Sir David Truelove, a gruff old party, 30 years Hawk senior, had his customary corner table at the third floor men's grill. Shafts of dusty sunlight pouring down from the tall leaded windows set the table crystal and silver afire, all sparkle and gleam. Above the table, ragged tendrils of tobacco smoke hung in wreaths and coils, turning and twisting slowly in the sunlit room. The dining room of Boodles was, by any standard, one of the poshest man caves in London. C took a Spartan sip of his gin and bitters, looked his subordinate up and down in a cursory fashion, and said,
I must say, a bit of convalescence becomes you. You're looking rather fit again, Alex. Steel true, blade straight, as Conan Doyle would have it, sit, sit.
Hawk, favoring his injured right leg, sat. He paid scant attention to such on-the-job injuries. They simply went with the territory. The nasty business in a Syrian prison hospital was already receding from memory.
Most kind of you, sir. I've been looking forward to this all week. Let's see if you still feel that way at the conclusion. What are you drinking? My club, my treat,
Truelove said, catching the waiter's eye.
Goslings, please. The Black Seal, neat.
So, trouble, I take it, Hawk said, after C had ordered his rum.
Well, no end of it, sadly. The bloody Chinese again.
Something new? I thought I was fairly well up to speed.
Well, Alex, you know those inscrutable mandarins in Beijing as well as I do. Always some new wrinkle up their red silk sleeves. It's that abominable South China Sea situation, I'm afraid.
Heating up?
Boiling over.
Hawks' rum arrived. He took a sip and said,
What now, sir? Don't tell me they've blockaded one of the world's busiest trade routes.
No, no, not yet, anyway.
Still, simply outrageous behavior. They unilaterally extended their territorial claims in the South China Sea, hundreds of miles south and east from their most southerly province of Henan, all done with zero regard for international maritime law. Now they claim a huge U-shaped area of the sea, a claim that overlaps areas of Vietnam, Malaysia, Philippines, Taiwan, and Brunei, say, belongs to them.
Oh, good Lord.
With what possible justification?
Well, Beijing says its right to the area comes from 2,000 years of history, when the Paracel and Spratly Island chains were regarded as integral parts of the Chinese nation. Vietnam says, rightly, that both island chains lie entirely within its territory, that it has actively ruled over both chains since the 17th century, and has the documents to prove it.
Bastards have created a flashpoint as dangerous as the Iranians at the Strait of Hormuz. Clearly, global implications.
Hmm?
Yes. And now they've begun to make intolerable demands. They're demanding that every vessel transiting these formerly wide-open routes must first ask permission of the Chinese government. We will not, bloody well, ask them permission for any such thing, nor will anyone else.
Of course not.
And the Western countermove? The United States is dramatically increasing its naval presence in the region, of course. And as you well know, they've deployed U.S. Marines to Darwin in Australia. Meanwhile, the PM, in a weak moment, actually had an extraordinary idea. The Allies are going to assemble a massive convoy, Alex. Warships from the Royal Navy, Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, Vietnam, and the Yanks, with an entire carrier battle group, and 7 or 8 other countries. Full steam ahead up their bloody noses and see what they'd do about it.
Now, for starters, they might take out a U.S. carrier with one of their killer satellites.
Hmm. Good to see the Syrians didn't break your brain as well as your leg.
That is a consideration, Alex. A few panty-waists in the U.S. Congress are thus far unwilling to go along with the scheme for fear of losing one of their billion-dollar babies. So, our convoy scheme is paralyzed at the moment.
But look, we're not going to sit around on our arses and let this stand, not for one blasted moment.
What are we going to do about it?
You mean, what are you going to do about it, dear boy? That's why I'm springing for lunch.
Yeah. No free lunch, as they say.
Never.
How can I help, sir?
I've been deemed fit for active service as of yesterday morning.
C looked around to establish if anyone was within earshot and then said,
We at Six have established a back-channel communication with a high-ranking Chinese naval officer. Someone with a working brain in his head who doesn't want to go to war over his government's deliberate and insane maritime provocation any more than we do.
This sounds good.
It is, very.
Hawk leaned forward and quietly said, The Chinese are well aware that they cannot possibly afford to go to war with the West now, in a decade perhaps, but certainly not now.
No, of course not. It's an obvious political ploy, albeit an extremely dangerous one. They wish to divert attention from their burgeoning internal domestic turmoil, particularly Tibet, with a bellicose show of force, show the peasant population and the increasingly restive middle class just how powerful they are now.
Sheer insanity.
But you're going to put a stop to it, Lord Hawk. I've arranged a secret rendezvous for you and Admiral Cao Zhang on a small island in a remote quadrant of the South China Sea. It was formerly a Japanese Air Force base, now abandoned because of the territorial dispute. There's an 8,000-foot airstrip there that should accommodate you nicely.
What kind of bus am I driving?
An American F-16 Viper, one of ours, especially modified for nighttime insertions. All the latest offensive and defensive goodies, I assure you. Kinetic energy weapons, all that sort of thing. Yeah, lovely airplane. Always wanted a crack at one. Yeah, you'll get one first thing tomorrow morning at Lakenheath RAF. 3 days of intensive flight training with a USAF chief instructor off your wingtip. And then you go off into the wild blue yonder. This Admiral Tsang, how high-ranking is he exactly? I mean to say, is he actually powerful enough to defuse this thing? Very high. Chinese chief of naval operations. You'll find an obsessively complete dossier waiting for you when you get home. Memorize it and burn it. Now then, Alex, what will you have for lunch? A keening wail suddenly filled the Viper's cockpit. Holy God. He'd just been painted by enemy radar. He whipped his head around and saw the Chinese SAM missile's exhaust flame streaking toward his Viper's afterburner. A Hong Chi 61A. Where the hell did that come from? Some kind of Chinese radar-proof shore battery on a nearby atoll? None of his so-called sophisticated gadgetry had even picked the damn thing up. He hauled back on the joystick and instantly initiated a vertical climb, standing the Viper on its tail and rocketing skyward. He deployed chaff aft and switched on the jamming devices located in the airplane's tail section. He was almost instantaneously at 40,000 feet and climbing, his eyes locked on the missile displayed on his radar screen. Its unverified speed, Hawk knew, was Mach 3. It was closing fast. The deadly little bastard blew right through his chaff field without a single degree of deviation. The Chinese were not behaving according to MI6's assessment of their military capability. With every passing second, his appointment with death went from possible to probable. He'd have to depend on the aircraft's jamming devices and his own evasive maneuvers to survive. He nosed the Viper over and put it into a screaming vertical dive, gaining himself precious seconds. The Hong Chi would have to recalculate before altering course and getting on his six again. He'd known from the second the SAM missile appeared on his screen that there was only one maneuver that stood a gnat's chance of saving him. A crash dive, straight down into the sea. Harry, but sometimes effective. To succeed, however, he had to allow the deadly weapon to get dangerously close to impacting and destroying the Viper. So close, in fact, that when he pulled out of the dive at the last possible instant, he would be so near the water's surface that the missile would have zero time to correct before it hit the water doing Mach 3. The missile nosed over as Hawk had and honed in. It was now closing at a ridiculous rate. His instrument panel told him he was clearly out of his bloody mind. The ingrained human instinct to run, to change course and escape, clawed around the edges of his conscious mind, but he'd erected a firewall around it that was impenetrable in times like this. It was those few precious white-hot moments precisely like this one that Alex Hawk lived for. Like his father and grandfather before him, he was a warrior to the bone. And he was bloody good at it. His focus at this critical moment, fueled by adrenaline, was borderline supernatural. His altimeter display screen was a blur, but he didn't see it. The collision avoidance alarms were screaming in his headphones, but he didn't hear them. His grip on the stick was feather light, his hands bone dry, and surgeon steady. His mind was calmly calculating the differential between the seconds remaining until the missile impacted the Viper and the seconds until the Viper impacted the sea. Ignoring his immediate surroundings, all the screeching alarms and flashing electronic warnings, Alex Hawk began his final mental countdown. The surface of the sea was approaching at a dizzying rate. 5, 4, 3, 2. Now! He pulled back on the stick and brought his nose up. He noticed beads of water racing across the exterior of his canopy and figured he might have caught the top of a wave coming out of the dive. You can't get any closer in this kind of a situation than when you get your nose wet. Some smart-ass RN combat instructor had said that low those many years ago. He barely heard the impact of the missile over the roar of his afterburners, but he did. He was in the clear, and he could visualize it, vaporizing upon contact with the concrete hard water at that speed. G-forces were fierce as he initiated his climb back to his former below-the-radar altitude. And that's when his starboard wingtip caught a cresting wave that sent his aircraft out of control. He was skimming over the sea like a winged frisbee. He felt a series of jolts as the fuselage made contact a couple of times and instinctively understood that the aircraft was seconds away from disintegrating right out from under his arse. He reached down and grabbed the red handle to his right, yanked it, and the canopy exploded outward into the airstream and disappeared. The rocket motors beneath his seat instantly propelled him out of the spinning cockpit and straight up into the black sky. Seconds later, his chute deployed, and he had a bird's-eye view of his airplane, turning into various sizes of scrap heap metal and disappearing into the deep. He yanked the cord, which disengaged him from his seat, watched it fall, and moments later his boots hit the water. It was cold as hell, but he started shedding gear as quickly as he could. He was unhurt, at least, and able to tread water until his life jacket inflated. So far so good, he thought, keeping his spirits up surprisingly well for a downed airman all alone. Normally there'd be an EPIRB attached to his shoulder harness. Upon contact with the water, it would immediately begin broadcasting his GPS coordinates to a passing satellite. He would hang out for a while here in the South China Sea and wait for one of Her Majesty's Navy choppers to pluck him out of the water and winch him up. But of course he had no distress radio beacon, no EPIRB. He figured the water temperature was cold enough to kill him eventually, but the thermal bodysuit he wore would stave off hypothermia long enough for him to have a shot at survival. He spun his body through 360 degrees. Nothing. No lights on the horizon, no planes in the sky. Nada. Nothing but a vast black sea stretching away in all directions. No EPIRB, no hope of immediate rescue. He was some 50 miles off the southern coast of China. If he was lucky, he was in a shipping channel. He looked at his dive watch. 5 hours minimum to sunrise. Nothing to do but hang here in limbo and see what happened next. It didn't take long. He felt the pressure of sudden underwater movement just before he felt a soft nudge in the small of his back. No pain, just a tentative probing by some large fish. Exactly what kind of fish it might have been was a question he preferred not to speculate about. But the words wouldn't go away. The bad one was snout. That was what it had felt like. Then there was the really bad one. Shark. Minutes later, there was another hit. A jarring slam to the rib cage on his right side. He'd glimpsed the shark's dorsal fin slicing toward him maybe 2 seconds before impact. It hurt like a bastard. He turned slowly in the water, minimizing his movements. Even in the pitch black, he could see the dorsal fin circling lazily around him. He knew a little bit about shark behavior. Right now, they were merely curious about this new object in the neighborhood. This could go either way. They could get bored with him and disappear. Or, the other way, they could shred him into several large chunks, ripping away his limbs first before fighting over the torso. Staying positive in adverse conditions was one of his strengths, so that's what he did. The more fins that appeared to encircle him, and the fact that his body was hanging there helplessly suspended in the freezing water, made it tough. But Alex Hawk, it had to be said, was nothing if not tough. He closed his eyes and immobilized his body. He forced himself to concentrate on all the good things in his life. His cherished son, named Alexei by his mother, who was now just 4 years old. He could see him running through the dappled sunlight on the green meadow in Hyde Park. The child's nurse, Nell, was chasing him, laughing. Nell was much more than a nanny. She was Hawk's much-loved woman, somewhat of a legend at Scotland Yard, and, in truth, Alexei's bodyguard. She had saved the little boy's life on more than one occasion. He'd been targeted by the KGB, and one of Hawk's greatest fears was leaving his son without a father. An hour passed, a very long hour. For whatever reason, God's infinite mercy, perhaps, the toothsome beasts had left him alone, at least for the moment. Cold had begun to claw its way inside his protective armor. He was shaking now, and his teeth were chattering away, much ado about nothing. It crossed his mind that freezing to death was a vastly better way to go than serving himself up as breakfast for the finny denizens of the deep. He slept, God knows how long. And then, the lights came on. Literally, he found himself the target of a shaft of pure white light. He looked up to his left and saw its source. A searchlight, mounted high in the superstructure of a massive aircraft carrier. And then another, and another, both lower and near the deck, picked him out. And then to his right, he became aware of the deep bass thumping of helicopter rotor blades. A spotlight from the chopper picked him up, and he saw a diver appear in the opening in the side of the fuselage. Could this possibly be a friendly? The odds were certainly against it, given China's recent military posturing in this little corner of the world. The diver splashed down about 6 feet away, and hopes for a miracle vanished when he told Hawk to remain calm in Mandarin. And then he went about securing the lifting harness to Hawk's body. Hawk had spent a lot of time in mainland China with his friend and companion, the great Scotland Yard criminalist Ambrose Congreve. In addition to being a brilliant detective, Ambrose had studied languages at Cambridge. While doing a 6-month stint in a Beijing prison for subversive activities that had never been proven, Congreve had given Hawk a rudimentary but substantial working of Chinese. "In the nick of time," Hawk said to the diver in his native tongue. "What? You arrived just in time. I was slowly freezing to death." "Silence. No conversation." "Have it your way. Just trying to be friendly." Hawk and his rescuer were winched up into the belly of the Chinese Akoi Hilo. Nobody aboard would talk to him. He was sure they knew an unidentified aircraft had entered their airspace and had been shot down, they imagined, by one of their missiles. So they were sensibly predisposed not to be chatty. Yeah, hell with them. He was still alive, wasn't he? He'd gotten out of tougher scrapes than this one over the years. The initial interrogation aboard the Chinese carrier was short but brutal. Still, he'd gotten out of it with a little more real damage than 3 broken fingers and a mild concussion. They told him he'd never leave the ship alive. Then they locked him up inside a stinking crew cabin in the bowels of the bilge with room for little more than a crappy bunk bed. He now lay on the top berth thinking very seriously about how the hell to escape. 2 military policemen with automatic weapons had delivered him to this lovely boudoir. He was fairly certain the same 2 would come for him when it was time for the more labor-intensive interrogation. They were thugs, those 2, viciously abusive but stupid, just the way he liked them. He'd feigned a far worse concussion than he'd actually suffered, forcing them to half-carry him down many flights of stairs, something that they did not appear to enjoy. He was consciously unconscious when they slammed into the tiny space and pulled him down from the upper berth. As he expected, they yanked him to his feet and wrapped his arms around their shoulders in order to keep him moving. He kept his head down, mumbling incoherently. When the MP on his left paused to kick open the half-closed door, he used the moment to grab a fistful of hair on each man's head and violently slam their skulls together hard enough to cause them to sink to the floor. He checked. They were out for the long count. He quickly stripped the uniform from the taller of the 2. It fit him badly, but it was good enough to get him up 8 flights of metal steps to the carrier's deck level without incident. Hawk had jet black hair, which helped. and he kept the cap brim pulled down and his face lowered. He also had the advantage of carrying an automatic rifle in case things got spicy. He saw a sailor open a hatch in the bulkhead and felt the cold blast of icy wind howl in from the flight deck. He waited 60 seconds and then stepped through to the outside himself. He had no earthly idea how he was going to execute the plan he'd devised, but that was of little concern. You had to be able to make this stuff up as you went along. He heard a sizable group of men laughing as they approached his positions and stepped back into the shadows. Pilots. There were 8 of them, all in flight suits and some wearing helmets. Some holding them loosely in their hands, kidding around, walking with that cocky jet jock walk. They were obviously en route across the expanse of darkened deck to their convoy of Sukhoi 33 carrier aircraft being readied for immediate launch. He remained hidden between 2 huge storage lockers behind the bulwark until just after they had passed. Then he fell in behind them, quickening his pace until he caught up with the lone straggler at the rear. Fortunately, he was by far the tallest of the lot. He approached his target from directly behind, shot out both hands, and used his thumbs on the carotid artery to paralyze the poor fellow and keep him on his feet. He gave the main group of pilots time to continue on, then pulled the unconscious one back into the shadows of the storage lockers. It was the work of a moment to zip himself inside the pilot's jumpsuit and don his boots and helmet and flip the visor down. He strode quickly, but not too quickly, across the deck and caught up with the jocular pilots just as they were climbing into their respective Sukhois. He made a beeline straight for the sole unoccupied fighter and then saluted the 2 attending crewmen who stood aside for him to mount the cockpit ladder. "Lovely night for flying, boys," he muttered in guttural Chinese, sliding himself down into the seat. After strapping himself in, he reached forward and flipped the switch that lowered the canopy. He then studied the instrument array and illuminated controls, deciding quickly exactly what did what. The Chinese had stolen so much aeronautical technology from the West that getting the hang of things was embarrassingly easy. He gave a hand signal to the crewman below, lit the candle, and taxied into position just behind the last jet in line for the center catapult. The blast shield had already risen from the deck behind the first jet in the squadron, and Hawk watched as the fighter was flung out over the ocean, afterburner glowing white hot. He must have been daydreaming because he suddenly heard the air boss screaming at him in his headphones, telling him to get his ass moving. The aircraft in front of him had advanced into position, and he had not followed immediately. Now he added a touch of power and tucked in where he belonged. There remained only 3 planes ahead of him. "So sorry, boss," he muttered in the time-honored traditional communicative style of fighter pilots all over the world. On a carrier, the air boss is God himself. "Don't let it happen again, Passion Flower, or I'll kick your ass all the way back to Shanghai." "Roger that, sir," Hawk said, advancing once more. "You forget something in your pre-flight, Passion Flower?" "No, sir," Hawk said. "Yeah? Check your fucking nav light switch for me. Just humor me." Oh, shit. He hadn't turned them on. Dumb mistake. And he couldn't afford to be dumb at this point, not in the slightest. "You awake down there, son? I'm inclined to pull your ass out of line." "Sir, no, sir. I'm good to go." "Yeah, well, you better damn well be. I've got my eye on you now, honey. You screw up even a little bit on this mission this morning, your ass is mine. You believe me?" "Sir, I always believe you, but I come back clean, I swear it." "Damn right you will. Now you get the hell off my boat, Passion Flower. I got more important things than little pisshands like you to worry about. You're up." Hawk moved forward and engaged the catapult hook inside its buried track. He heard the blast shield rumble up into position behind him and looked to his left, nodding. A signal to the launch chief that he was poised and ready. The man raised his right arm and dropped it, meaning any second now. Hawk's right hand automatically went to the "oh shit" bar on the right side of the canopy. Adrenaline flooded Hawk's veins as he gripped the bar with his right hand. being launched violently into space by a modern carrier catapult, was as close as any human being can come to the experience of being in a catastrophic fatal car crash and surviving. It was that intense. Early on, after a lot of expensive hardware had gone into the drink, some aeronautical genius had figured out that most pilots instinctively grabbed the aircraft's controls too quickly after launch. It's scary to feel out of control when your wheels separate from the mothership. Now, every fighter had a handhold forward and to the right inside the canopy. You grabbed it just before they pulled the trigger, and thus its name, the oh shit bar. During a cat shot, the time it took you to remove your hand from that bar and take hold of the controls was precisely, to the nanosecond, the right amount of time needed to elapse before you seized control after leaving the leading edge of the deck. He was airborne. He looked back down at the deck lights on the Varyag, the carrier growing rapidly smaller as he gained altitude. He suppressed any feelings of joy over escaping an agonizing death at the hands of the most sophisticated torturers on the planet. He wasn't out of the woods yet, he told himself as he climbed upward to join his squadron's flight. Their heading was a northerly course that would take them over the Paracel Islands, exactly the wrong direction. He needed to be headed south-southeast, and he needed to get moving or he'd miss his rapidly diminishing window. The one chance he had to try to defuse a crisis with global implications. The rim of the Earth was edged in violent pink as he slipped into his designated slot at the rear of the tight formation. There was a minimum of radio chat for which he was thankful. There was normally a lot of banter at this stage, and he didn't want to hear any questions or inside wisecracks over the radio that he couldn't respond to without sacrificing his cover. He needed precious time to remain anonymous until he could figure out how the hell to peel off and head for his mission destination without arousing the slightest suspicion. He knew what he had to do now, although he didn't much like it. Land on the island airstrip of Sichuan Island, meet with his Chinese Admiral Sang, and fulfill C's back-channel charge as best he could. Find a strategic way to avert the imminent showdown and eliminate another global flashpoint. He didn't much like the fact that a high-tech SAM had been launched at him streaking across some dinky little atoll in the middle of nowhere, and that a Chinese carrier just happened to be sailing the sea lane where he went down. No, he simply couldn't shake the distinct impression that this might all be an elaborate setup, that the wily Chinese were going to use his violation of their airspace as proof positive that the West was being deliberately provocative. They'd trot out his blackened corpse and twisted pieces of his American fighter jet on global TV, use him to justify an even more aggressive posture in the South China Sea, take retaliatory measures against Taiwan, Japan, or Vietnam. Next step, war. That's how he saw it, anyway. C might disagree, but C wasn't sitting in the hot seat with his ass on the line. Now he had little choice. He flew on with the formation, heading north toward the Pacific. He looked at his watch, calculated time and distance to his target. A long way to go, and a short time to get there. And suddenly, it came to him. He thumbed the transmit button on his radio.
Flight leader, this is our passion flower, over.
Roger, passion flower, this is red flight leader, go ahead, over.
Experiencing mechanical difficulty, system malfunctions, over.
What is your situation?
I'm flying hot, sir. Engine overheat. It's getting worse. Running override systems checked now. Doesn't look good.
Are you declaring an emergency?
Negative. I think I can throttle back and make it home to mother. Request permission to abort and return, over.
Permission granted, over.
Roger that, red flight leader. Passion flower, returning to the Varag, over.
Hawk peeled away from the formation and went into a steep diving turn away from his flight. The sun was up now, just a sliver on the horizon, streaks of red light streaming across the sea below.
When Red Flight was out of radar range, he corrected course and went to full throttle. By his latest calculations, he'd touched down just in time. He sat back and allowed himself his first smile in hours. If he didn't get blown out of the sky, it promised to be another beautiful day in paradise.
What comes around? Chapter 1. The bright blue waters of Penobscot Bay beckoned. Cam Hooker paused to throw open his dressing room window. Glorious morning, all right. Sunlight sparkled out on the bay, flashing white seabirds wheeled and dove above. He took a deep breath of pine-scented Maine air and assessed the morning's weather. Sunny now, but threatening skies. Fresh breeze out of the east and a moderate chop. 15 knots sustained, maybe gusting to 30. Barometer falling, increased cloudiness, possible thunderheads moving in from the west by mid-morning. Chance of rain showers later on, 60 to 70%, give or take. Perfect. Certainly nothing an old salt like Cameron Hooker couldn't handle. It was Sunday, praise the Lord, his favorite day of the week. The day he got to take himself, his New York Times, his Marlboros, and whatever tattered paperback spy novel he was currently headlong into reading for the third time, an old Alistair MacLean, out on his boat for a few tranquil hours of peace, quiet, and bliss. Hooker had sailed her, his black ketch Marakaya, every single Sunday morning of his life for nigh on to 40 years now, rain or shine, sleet, hail, or snow. Man alone, a singleton, solitary. It was high summer again, and summer meant grandchildren by the dozen. Toddlers, rugrats, and various ragamuffins running roughshod throughout his rambling old seaside cottage on North Haven Island. Haven, ah! Up and down the back stairs they rumbled, storming through his cherished rose gardens, dashing inside and out, marching through his vegetable patches like jackbooted thugs, and even invading the sanctuary of his library, all the while shouting at peak decibels some mysterious new battle cry, "Huzzah! Huzzah!" picked up God knew where. It was the revolutionary victory cheer, according to General George Washington, he knew that, but this intellectually impoverished gizmo generation had not a clue who George Washington was. Of that much, he was certain. You knew you were down in the deep severe when not a single young soul in your entire clan had the remotest clue who the hell of the father of our country was. Back in Hook's day, portraits of the great man beamed benevolence down on you from every wall in every classroom. He was our father, father of our country, your country. Why, if you just had told young Cam back then that in just one or two generations, the general himself would have been scrubbed clean from history, why, he would have... "What are you thinking about, dear?" his wife said, interrupting his dark reverie at the breakfast table later that morning. Jillian was perusing what he'd always referred to as the women's sports section, sometimes known as the bridal pages in the Sunday edition of the New York Times. Apparently, it was the definitive weekly who's who of who'd married whom last week. For all of those out there who, like his wife of 60 years, were still keeping score, he supposed. "You're frowning, dear," she said. "Mm." He scratched his grizzled chin and sighed, gazing out at the forest of green trees reaching down to the busy harbor. On the surface, all was serene. But even now, a mud-caked munchkin wielding a blue frisbee bat advanced stealthily up the hill, stalking one of his old chocolate labs sleeping in the foreground. "Will you look at that?" he mused. Jillian put the paper down and peered at him over the toaster. "What is it, dear?" "Oh, nothing. It's July, you know," he said, rapping sharply on the window to alert his dog of the impending munchkin attack.
"July? What about it?"
"July is the cruelest month," he said, not looking up from the book review. "Not April. July. That's all."
"Oh, good heavens," she said, and snatched away her paper.
"Precisely," he said, but got no reply. Dismissed, he stood and leaned across the table to kiss his wife's proffered cheek. She said, stroking his own freshly shaved cheek,
If you'd relent for once in your life and only let them have a television just once. That old RCA black and white portable up in the attic would do nicely. Or even one of those handheld computer thingies, whatever they're called. Silence would reign supreme in this house once more, but no, not you.
A television in this house, he said. Oh, no, not in this house. Never.
Grabbing his smokes, his newspapers, and his canvas sail bag, and swinging out into the backyard, slamming the screen door behind him, he headed down the sloping green lawn to his dock. The old Hooker property, some 15 acres of it, was right at the tip of Crabtree Point, with magnificent views of the Fox Islands Thoroughfare Inlet and the Camden Hills to the west. He was the fifth generation of Hookers to summer on this island, not that anyone cared a whit about such things anymore. His ancestor, Captain Osgood Hooker, had first come here from Boston to recuperate from the deleterious effects of the confinements of city life, as he'd put it in a letter Cam had found in a highboy in the dining room. Traditions, history, common sense, and common courtesy, things like that, had all gone to hell or by the wayside. Hell, they were trying to get rid of Christmas. Some goddamn school district in Ohio had banned the singing of Silent Night. Silent Night. He could see her out there at the far end of the dock when he crested the hill. Just the sight of her never failed to move him. His heart skipped a beat, literally, every time she hove into view. Marakaya was her name. She was an old Alden-designed catch, and he'd owned her for longer than time. 40 feet on the waterline, wooden hull, gleaming black all-grip, with a gold cove stripe running down her flank beneath the gunwales. Her decks were teak, her spars were Sitka spruce, and she was about as yar as any damn boat currently plying the waters of coastal Maine, in his humble opinion. Making his way down the hill to the sun-dappled water, he couldn't take his eyes off her. She'd never looked better. He had a young kid this summer, sophomore at Yale, living down here in the boathouse. The boy helped him keep Marakaya in proper Bristol fashion. She was a looker, all right, but she was a goer, too. He'd won the Block Island race on her back in 87, and then the Nantucket Opera House Cup the year after that. Now barely memories, just dusty trophies on the mantle in someone's goddamn not-so-humble opinion. "Morning, Skipper," the crew-cut blonde kid said, popping his head up from the companionway. "Coffee's on below, sir. You're good to go."
"Thanks, Ben. Good on you, mate."
"Good day for it, sir," the young fellow said, looking up at the big blue sky with his big white smile. He was a good kid, this Ben Sparhawk. Sixth generation North Haven. Dad and granddad were both hard-working lobstermen. Came from solid Maine stock, too. Men from another time. Men who could toil at being a fisherman, a farmer, sailor, lumberman, a shipwright and a quarryman all rolled into one, and master of all. Salt of the earth, formerly salt of the sea, Thoreau had called such men. Ben was a history major at New Haven on a full scholarship. He had a head on his shoulders, he did, and he used it. He came up from the galley below and quickly moved to the port side bow, freeing the forward, spring, and aft mooring lines before leaping easily from the deck down onto the dock. "Prettiest boat in the harbor she is, sir," Ben said, looking at her gleaming mahogany topsides with some pride.
"Abso-fucking-lutely, son," Cam said, laughing out loud at his good fortune. Another glorious day awaiting him out there on the water.
He was one of the lucky ones, and he knew it. A man in good health, of sound mind, and looking forward to the precious balance of his time here on Earth, specifically in the great state of Maine. Cam Hooker was semi-retired from the agency now. He'd been director under George H.W. Bush, and he'd had a good run. Under his watch, the CIA was a tightly run ship. No scandals, no SAFUs, no bullshit. Just a solid record of intelligence successes around the world. He was proud of his service to his country, and it pained him to see the condition it was in now. Diminished was the word, goddammit. How could the bastards, all of them, let this happen to his magnificent country? He shook off such thoughts, leaving them well ashore as he stepped aboard his boat. He went aft and climbed down into the cockpit. First thing he did, He kicked off his topsiders so he could feel the warm teak decks on the soles of his feet. He felt better already.
Smell that air.
Ben Sparkhawk had thoughtfully removed and stowed the sail cover from the mainsail. Cam grabbed the main halyard, took a couple of turns around the starboard winch, and started grinding, the big mainsail blooming with fresh main air as it rose majestically up the stick. Some days, when there was no wind to speak of, he'd crank up the old universal diesel, 42-horsepower lump of steel that had served him well over the decades. Now, with a freshening breeze, he winched the main up, loosening the sheets and letting her sails flop in the wind. The jib was roller-furling, one of his few concessions to modernity, and at his advancing age a godsend for its ease of use. He also had a storm trysail rigged that he'd deploy when he got out beyond the harbor proper.
"Shove that bow off for me, Ben, will you?" he said,
putting the helm over and sheeting in the main.
"Aye, skipper,"
the kid said. And moments later, he was pointed in the right direction and moving away from the dock toward the thoroughfare running between North Haven and Vinyl Haven Islands. He turned to wave goodbye to the youngster, saw him smiling and waving back with both hands. He was surprised to find his old blue eyes suddenly gone all blurry with tears. My God, he wished he'd had a son like that. Chapter 2. He threaded his way, tacking smartly through the teeming thoroughfare. It was crowded as hell, always was this time of year, especially this 4th of July weekend. Boats and yachts of every description hove into view. The Vinyl Haven ferry steaming stolidly across, knockabouts and dinghies. A lovely old Nat Harrishoff gaff-headed Bar Harbor 30. And here came one of the original internationals built in Norway, sparring with the looters. And even a big Palmer Johnson stinkpot. Anchored just off Foy Brown's yard, over 100 feet long, he guessed, with New York Yacht Club burgees emblazoned on her smokestack. Pretty damn fancy for these parts, if you asked him. As was his custom, once he was in open water, he had put her hard over, 1 mile from shore, and headed for the pretty little harbor over on the mainland at Rockport. Blowing like stink out here now, clouding up, front moving in for damn sure. He stood to windward at the helm, both hands on the big wheel, his feet planted wide, and sang a few bars of his favorite sailor's ditty, sung to the tune of an old English ballad, Robin on the Moor. It was a young captain on Cranberry Isles to dwell. He took the schooner Arnold, the one you all know well. She was a topsail schooner and hailed from Calais, Maine. They took a load from Boston across the raging main. The words caught in his throat. He'd seen movement down in the galley below. Not believing his eyes, he looked again. Nothing. Perhaps just a light shadow from a porthole sliding across the cabin floor as he fell off the wind a bit? Nothing at all. And yet it had spooked him there for a second, but he...
Hello, Cam.
A strange-looking man says, suddenly making himself visible at the foot of the steps, down in the galley. And then he was climbing up into the cockpit.
The hell,
Cam said, startled.
Relax. I don't bite.
The hell are you? The hell are you doing aboard my boat?
Cam eased the main a bit to reduce the amount of heel and moved higher to the windward side of the helm station. Planted himself and bent his knees, ready for any false move from years of habit in the military and later as a special agent out in the field. The stranger made no move other than to plop himself down on a faded red cushion on the leeward side of the cockpit and cross his legs.
Well, you don't recognize me. I'm hurt. Maybe it's the long hair and the beard. Here, I know. Look into the eyes, Cam. Can always remember the eyes.
Cam looked.
Well, was that spider, for God's sake?
Couldn't be.
But it was. Spider Payne, for Christ's sake. A guy who'd worked for him at CIA briefly the year before he'd retired. Good agent. A guy on the way up. He'd lost track of him long ago, and now? And there'd been some kind of trouble, but he couldn't exactly recall.
Spider! Sure! Sure, I recognize you, Camp said, keeping his voice as even as he could manage. What in God's name is going on?
Well, I knew this might freak you out, you know, if I just showed up on the boat like this. Sorry, I drove all night from Boston and came over to the island on the ferry from Rockland last night, parked my truck at Foy Brown's boatyard, and went up to that little inn, the Nebo Lodge. Fully booked. Not a bed to be had, wouldn't you know. Forgot it was the 4th of July weekend. Stupid, I guess. Well, Spider, you know this is highly goddamn unprofessional, showing up unannounced like this, uninvited. Are you all right? What's this about?
Well, how I found you, you mean?
Why you found me, Spider?
Well, I remembered you always had a picture of a sailboat in your office at Langley, an oil painting, a black boat at a dock below your summer house in Maine. I remember the boat's name. Maracaya. So when I couldn't get a room, I went downstairs to the bar there and had a few beers, asked around about a boat called the Maracaya. The old guy said, yep, old and catch. He's moored out by the hooker place out at the end of Crabtree Point. And here I am.
No, not here, you fucking are, you idiot. How did you get aboard? I got a kid who looks after the boat. He never let you aboard.
Cam, come on. It was 4 in the morning. Everyone was asleep. I climbed aboard and slept in the sail locker up forward. Say, it's blowing pretty good out here, 20 knots. Think you should put in a reef?
Spider, you better tell me quick why you're here or you're swimming back. I'm dead serious.
I sent you a letter a while back. You remember that. I asked for your help. I was in a little trouble with the French government. Arrested by the French for kidnapping and suspicion of murder. No body, no proof, but sentenced to 30 years for kidnapping a known Arab terrorist off the streets of Paris. Guy believed responsible for the metro bombing that killed 30 Parisians in 2011. I was the number two guy in our Paris station cam, operating within the law. Rendition was what we did to them. Well, come to the point. I don't need all this history. I had a brilliant career. Not a blemish. And then I got into trouble. The agency threw me under the bus. The agency, Spider, had nothing to do with it. That decision came down out of the White House. It may surprise you to learn that the president was more concerned about our relationship with one of our most powerful European allies than you. It was a delicate time. You're a victim of bad timing. My whole fucking life is destroyed because of bad timing. I'm sorry about that. But it's got nothing to do with me. I retired prior to 9/11, remember? Frankly, I never approved of rendition in the first place. Enhanced interrogation, Abu Ghraib, all those black funds you had at your disposal, not the way we played the game, son, not in my day. Now look, I asked you to help me. I've yet to get a response, Cam, so now I'm here, in person. To ask you again right now, will you help me? They ruined my life. I lost everything, my job, my shitty little farm in Aix-en-Provence. My wife took the children and disappeared. Now there's an international warrant for my arrest by the French government, and my own country won't step in, Cam. All my savings gone to lawyers on appeal. I'm broke, Cam. I'm finished. Look at me. I'm falling out the window. Jesus Christ, Spider, so what do you want? Money? I want help. Fuck you. Really? You screwed up, mister, big time. You jumped the shark, pal. You're not my problem. Really? You don't think I'm your problem, Cam? Are you sure about that? Spider stood up and took a step closer to the helm. Cam turned his cold blue eyes on him. Eyes that had cowed far tougher men than this one by a factor of 10. Are you threatening me, son? I see it in your eyes. You think I may be getting a little long in the tooth, don't you, pal? But I'll rip your beating heart out, believe me.
That's your response, then?
Look, you want me to beg? I come to you on bended knee.
humbly to beseech you for help. And you say you'll rip my heart out?
The man was weeping.
All right, Spider, listen. You're obviously upset. You need help, yes, but not from me. You need to see someone, a specialist. I can help you do that. I'll even pay for it. Look here, I'm going to flip her around now and head back to the dock. I'll see that you get proper care. Uncleat that main sheet, will you, and prepare to come about. It's really blowing out here now, so pay attention to what you're doing.
They locked eyes for what seemed an eternity.
Do as I said, Cam told him.
Cam realized too late what Spider was going to do. In one fluid motion, the rogue agent freed the main sheet sail to allow the boom to swing free, grabbed the helm, put her hard over to leeward, and jibed. The jibe is the single most violent action you can take on board a big sailboat in a blow. You put yourself in mortal danger when you turn your bow away from the wind instead of up into it. You stick your tail up into the face of the wind and she kicks your ass hard and fast. The standing rigging and sails shriek like wounded banshees as the huge mainsail and the heavy wooden boom caught the wind from behind and came whipping across the cockpit at blinding speed. Spider knew the boom was coming, of course, and ducked in the nick of time. Cam was not so lucky. The boom slammed into the side of the old man's head, pulverizing the skull, spilling his brains into the sea, and carrying him out of the cockpit and up onto the deck. Only the lifeline saved him from rolling overboard. Spider stared down at his old mentor with mixed emotions. At one point, he'd worshipped this man. But rage is a powerful thing. He'd been ruined by Cam and others like him at the highest levels of the agency. He knew he himself was going down soon, but he was determined not to go down alone. Revenge is another powerful thing. He knelt down beside the dead man trying to sort out his feelings. A lock of white hair had fallen across Cam's eyes, and he gently lifted it away. He tried for remorse, but couldn't find it inside himself anymore. It looked like someone had dropped a cantaloupe on the deck from up at the masthead. A dark red stain flowed outward from Hooker's crushed and splintered head, soaking into the teak. What more was there to say? An unfortunate accident, but it happens all the time? Tough luck, Cam, he thought to himself with a thin smile. Another victim of bad timing. Spider grabbed the helm, sheeted in the main, and headed up into the wind. When the boat's forward motion stalled, he grabbed the binoculars hanging from the mizzen and raised them to his eyes. He did a 360-degree sweep of the horizon. Nothing. No other vessels in sight. Nobody on the shore. He was about a mile and a half from the shoreline. The trees encroaching down to the rocky shore break would provide good cover. He looked at his watch and went below to don his wetsuit with a short swim to shore. The old ketch would drift with the currents. Once back on terra firma, he would disappear into the woods, bury the wetsuit, and walk to town in his bathing suits, flip-flops, and t-shirt. Just another hippie tourist day tripper, come to celebrate America's independence with the Yankee pilgrims and Puritans. The next ferry to the mainland was at noon. He checked off yet another name on his list. Maybe it was true that the old Spider was indeed a man without a future, but he still had plenty of time to kill. Chapter 3. Tea Kettle Cottage on the south shore of Bermuda is no ordinary house. For starters, it is the home of the 6th richest man in England, though you'd never guess that from the looks of the place. A small, modest house, it has survived a couple of centuries and at least a dozen hurricanes. It also happens to be the sanctum sanctorum of a very private man. Few people have ever even seen it. To do that, first you'd have to find it. Anyone searching the coast road along the southern shore would find a modest limestone house hidden from view. The seaward